Chapter 7. There are ruins, steeped in shadow, and a blood-red sun going down in turmoil behind distant hills. Overhead, soft-bellied clouds panic toward the horizon like whales before the harpoon, and the wind runs addict's fingers through the trees that line the street. In and in. I know this place. I pick my way between the devastated walls of ruins, trying not to brush against them because whenever I do, they give out muted gunshots and screams as if whatever conflict murdered this city is soaked into the remaining stonework. At the same time, I'm moving quite fast because there's something following me, something that has no such qualms about touching the ruins. I can chart its progress quite accurately by the tide of gunfire and anguish swelling behind me. It is closing. I try to speed up, but there's a tightness in my throat and chest that isn't helping matters. Jimmy DeSoto steps out from behind the shattered stub of a tower. I'm not really surprised to see him here, but his ruined face still gives me a jolt. He grins with what's left of his features and puts a hand on my shoulder. I try not to flinch.
"Lila Began," he says, and nods back to where I've come from. "Run that by Bancroft's fancy lawyer."
"I will," I say, moving past him. But his hand stays on my shoulder, which must mean his arm is stretching out behind me like hot wax. I stop, guilty at the pain that must be causing him, but he's still there at my shoulder. I start moving again.
"Gonna turn and fight?"
he asks conversationally, drifting along beside me without apparent effort or footing.
"With what?"
I say, opening my empty hands.
"Should have armed yourself, pal, big time."
"Virginia told us not to fall for the weakness of weapons." Jimmy DeSoto snorts derisively.
"Yeah. And look where that stupid bitch ended up. 80 to 100, no remission."
"You can't know that," I say absently, more interested in the sounds of pursuit behind me. "You died years before that happened."
"Oh, come on, who really dies these days?"
"Try telling that to a Catholic. And anyway, you did die, Jimmy. Irretrievably, as I recall."
"What's a Catholic?"
"Tell you later. You got any cigarettes?"
"Cigarettes? What happened to your arm?"
I break the spiral of non-sequiturs and stare down at my arm. Jimmy's got a point. The scars on my forearm have turned into a fresh wound, blood welling up and trickling down into my hand, so of course... I reach up to my left eye and find the wetness below it. My fingers come away bloody.
"Lucky one," Jimmy DeSoto says judiciously. "They missed the socket."
"He should know. His own left socket is a glutted wall of gore. All that was left at Inanen when he dug the eyeball out with his fingers. No one ever found out what he was hallucinating at the time. By the time they got Jimmy and the rest of the Inanen beachhead DH'd for psychosurgery, the Defender's virus had scrambled their minds beyond retrieval. The program was so virulent that at the time the clinic didn't even dare keep what was left on stack for study. The remains of Jimmy DeSoto are on a sealed disk with red data contaminant decals, somewhere in the basement at Envoy Corps HQ.
"I've got to do something about this,"
I say, a little desperately. The sounds awoken from the walls by my pursuer are growing dangerously close. The last of the sun is slipping behind the hills. Blood spills down my arm and face.
"Smell that?"
Jimmy asks, lifting his own face to the chilly air around us.
"They're changing it."
"What?"
But even as I snap the retort, I can smell it as well. A fresh, invigorating scent. Not unlike the incense back at the Hendrix, but subtly different. Not quite the heady decadence of the original odor I fell asleep to, only...
"Gotta go,"
Jimmy says. And I'm about to ask him where when I realize he means me, and I'm... awake. My eyes snapped open on one of the psychedelic murals of the hotel room. Slim, waif-like figures in caftans dotted across a field of green grass and yellow and white flowers. I frowned and clutched at the hardened scar tissue on my forearm. No blood. With the realization, I came fully awake and sat up in the big crimson bed. The shift in the smell of incense that had originally nudged me toward consciousness was fully resolved into that of coffee and fresh bread. the Hendrix's olfactory wake-up call. Light was pouring into the dimmed room through a flaw in the polarized glass of the window.
"You have a visitor,"
the voice of the Hendrix said briskly.
"Oh, what time is it?"
I croaked. The back of my throat seemed to have been liberally painted with supercooled glue.
10:16 locally. You have slept for 7 hours and 42 minutes.
"And my visitor?"
"Almal Prescott," the hotel said. "Do you require breakfast?"
I got out of bed and headed for the bathroom.
"Yes, coffee with milk, white meat, well-cooked, and fruit juice of some kind. You can send Prescott up."
By the time the door chimed at me, I was out of the shower and padding around in an iridescent blue bathrobe trimmed with gold braid. I collected my breakfast from the service hatch and balanced the tray on one hand while I opened the door. Almal Prescott was a tall, impressive-looking African woman, topping my sleeve by a couple of centimeters, her hair braided back with dozens of oval glass beads in 7 or 8 of my favorite colors, and her cheekbones lined with some sort of abstract tattooing. She stood on the threshold in a pale gray suit and a long black coat turned up at the collar, and looked at me doubtfully.
"Mr. Kovacs?"
"Yes, come in. Would you like some breakfast?" I laid the tray on the unmade bed.
"No, thank you, Mr. Kovacs. I am Lorenz Bancroft's principal legal representative via the firm of Prescott, Forbes & Hernandez. Mr. Bancroft informed me..."
"Yes, I know." I picked up a piece of grilled chicken from the tray.
"The point is, Mr. Kovacs, we have an appointment with Dennis Nyman at Psychosec in..."
Her eyes flickered briefly upward to consult a retinal watch.
30 minutes.
"I see," I said, chewing slowly. "I didn't know that."
"I've been calling since 8 this morning, but the hotel refused to put me through. I didn't realize you would sleep so late."
I grinned at her through a mouthful of chicken. "Faulty research, then. I was only sleeved yesterday." She stiffened a little at that, but then a professional calm asserted itself. She crossed the room and took a seat on the window shelf.
"We'll be late, then," she said. "I guess you need breakfast."
It was cold in the middle of the bay. I climbed out of the auto cab into watery sunshine and a buffeting wind. It had rained during the night, and there were still a few piles of gray cumulus skulking around inland, sullenly resisting the attempts of a stiff sea breeze to sweep them away. I turned up the collar of my summer suit and made a mental note to buy a coat. Nothing serious. Something coming to mid-thigh with a collar and pockets big enough to stuff your hands in. Beside me, Prescott was looking unbearably snug inside her coat. She paid off the cab with a swipe of her thumb, and we both stood back as it rose. A welcome rush of warm air from the lift turbines washed over my hands and face. I blinked my eyes against the small storm of grit and dust and saw how Prescott raised one slender arm to do the same. Then the cab was gone, droning away to join the beehive activity in the sky above the mainland. Prescott turned to the building behind us and gestured with one laconic thumb.
"This way."
I pushed my hands into the inadequate pockets of my suit and followed her lead. Bent slightly into the wind, we picked our way up the long, winding steps to Psychosec Alcatraz. I'd expected a high-security installation, and I wasn't disappointed. Psychosec was laid out in a series of long, low, double-story modules with deeply recessed windows, reminiscent of a military command bunker. The only break in this pattern was a single dome at the western end, which I guessed had to house the satellite uplink gear. The whole complex was a pale granite gray, and the windows a smoky, reflectant orange. There was no holo display or broadcast publicity. In fact, nothing to announce we'd got the right place except a sober plaque laser-engraved into the sloping stone wall of the entrance block. Psychosec S.A. DHF retrieval and secure holding. Clonic resleeving. Above the plaque was a small black sentry eye, flanked by heavily grilled speakers. Almal Prescott raised her arm and waved at it. "Welcome to Psychosec Alcatraz," a construct voice said briskly.
Please identify yourself within the 15-second security time limit.
Almal Prescott and Takashi Kovac to see Director Nyman. We have an appointment.
A thin green scanning laser flickered over us both from head to foot, and then a section of the wall hinged smoothly back and down, forming a passage inside. Glad to get out of the wind, I stepped nimbly into the niche and followed orange runway lights down a short corridor into a reception area, leaving Prescott to bring up the rear. As soon as we stepped off the walkway and into reception, the massive door slab rumbled upright and closed again. Solid security. Reception was a circular, warmly lit area with banks of seats and low tables set at the cardinal compass points. There were small groups of people seated north and east, conversing in low tones. In the center was a circular desk where a receptionist sat behind a battery of secretarial equipment. No artificial constructs here. This was a real human being. A slim young man, barely out of his teens, who looked up with intelligent eyes as we approached.
You can go right through, Miss Prescott. The director's office is up the stairs and third door to your right.
Thank you.
Prescott took the lead again, turning back briefly to mutter as soon as we were out of earshot of the receptionist.
Nyman's a bit impressed with himself since this place was built, but he's basically a good person. Try not to let him irritate you.
Sure. We followed the receptionist's instructions until, outside the aforementioned door, I had to stop and suppress a snigger. Nyman's door, no doubt in the best possible earth taste, was pure mirror wood from top to bottom. After the high-profile security system and flesh-and-blood reception, it seemed about as subtle as the vaginal spittoons at Madame Mee's War 4 warehouse. My amusement must have been evident, because Prescott gave me a frown as she knocked on the door.
Come.
Sleep had done wonders for the interface between my mind and my new sleeve. Composing my rented features, I followed Prescott into the room. Nyman was at his desk, ostensibly working at a gray and green-colored holodisplay. He was a thin, serious-looking man who affected steel-rimmed external eyelenses to go with his expensively cut black suit and short, tidy hair. His expression, behind the lenses, was slightly resentful. He'd not been happy when Prescott phoned him from the cab to say we would be delayed, but Bancroft had obviously been in touch with him because he accepted the later appointment time with the stiff acquiescence of a disciplined child.
"Since you've requested a viewing of our facilities here, Mr. Kovac, shall we start? I've cleared my agenda for the next couple of hours, but I do have clients waiting."
Something about Nyman's manner brought Warden Sullivan to mind, but it was an altogether smoother, less embittered Sullivan. I glanced over Nyman's suit and face. Perhaps if the warden had made his career in storage for the super-rich instead of the criminal element, he might have turned out like this.
Fine.
It got pretty dull after that. Psychosec, like most DHF depots, wasn't much more than a gigantic set of air-conditioned warehouse shelves. We tramped through basement rooms, cooled to the 7 to 11 degrees Celsius recommended by the makers of altered carbon, peered at racks of the big 30-centimeter expanded format discs, and admired the retrieval robots that ran on wide-gauge rails along the storage walls.
"It's a duplex system," Nyman said proudly. "Every client is stored on two separate discs in different parts of the building. Random code distribution. Only the central processor can find them both, and there's a lock on the system to prevent simultaneous access to both copies. To do any real damage, you'd have to break in and get past all the security systems twice."
I made polite noises.
"Our satellite uplink operates through a network of no less than 18 secure clearing orbital platforms, leased in random sequence."
Nyman was getting carried away with his own sales pitch. He seemed to have forgotten that neither Prescott nor myself were in the market for Psychosec services.
"No orbital is leased for more than 20 seconds at a time. Remote storage updates come in via needlecast, with no way to predict the transmission route."
Strictly speaking, that wasn't true. Given an artificial intelligence of sufficient size and inclination, you'd get it right sooner or later. But this was clutching at straws. The kind of enemies who used AIs to get at you didn't need to finish you off with a particle blaster to the head. I was looking in the wrong place.
"Can I get access to Bancroft's clones?"
I asked Prescott abruptly.
"From a legal point of view?" Prescott shrugged. Mr. Bancroft's instructions give you carte blanche, as far as I know.
Carte blanche? Prescott had been springing these on me all morning. The words almost had the taste of heavy parchment. It was like something an Elaine Marriott character would say in a settlement years flick.
Well, you're on Earth now. I turned to Nyman, who nodded grudgingly.
There are some procedures, he said. We went back up to ground level, along corridors that forcibly reminded me of the resleeving facility at Bay City Central, by their very dissimilarity. No rubber-wheeled gurney tracks here. The sleeve transporters would be air-cushion vehicles, and the corridor walls were decked out in pastel shades. The windows, bunker peepholes from the outside, were framed and cornished in Gaudi-style waves on the inside. At one corner we passed a woman, cleaning them by hand. I raised an eyebrow. No end to the extravagance.
Nyman caught the look. There are some jobs that robot labor just never gets quite right, he said.
I'm sure. The clone banks appeared on our left. Heavy sealed doors in beveled and sculpted steel, counterpointing the ornate windows. We stopped at one, and Nyman peered into the retina scan set beside it. The door hinged smoothly outward, fully a meter thick in tungsten steel. Within was a 4-meter-long chamber with a similar door at the far end. We stepped inside, and the outer door swung shut with a soft thud that pushed the air into my ears.
"This is an airtight chamber," Nyman said redundantly. "We will receive sonic cleansing to ensure that we bring no contaminants into the clone bank. No reason to be alarmed."
A light in the ceiling pulsed on and off in shades of violet to signify that the dust-off was in progress, and then the second door opened with no more sound than the first. We walked out into the Bancroft family vault.
I'd seen this sort of thing before.
Rylene Kawahara had maintained a small one for her transit clones on New Beijing, and of course the Corps had them in abundance. Still, I'd never seen anything quite like this. The space was oval, dome-ceilinged, and must have extended through both stories of the installation. It was huge, the size of a temple back home. Lighting was low, a womb-like orange, and the temperature was blood-warm. The clone sacs were everywhere, vein, translucent pods of the same orange as the light, suspended from the ceiling by cables and nutrient tubes. The clones were vaguely discernible within, fetal bundles of arms and legs, but fully grown. Or at least most were. Toward the top of the dome I could see smaller sacs, where new additions to the stock were being cultured. The sacs were organic, a toughened analog of womb lining, and they would grow with the fetus within to the meter-and-a-half lozenges in the lower half of the vault. The whole crop hung there like an insane mobile, just waiting for some huge, sickly breeze to stir it into motion. Nyman cleared his throat, and both Prescott and I shook off the paralyzed wonder that had gripped us on the threshold.
"This may look haphazard," he said, "but the spacing is computer-generated."
"I know." I nodded and went closer to one of the lower sacks.
"It's fractal-derived, right?"
Yes.
Nyman seemed almost to resent my knowledge. I peered in at the clone. Centimeters away from my face, Miriam Bancroft's features dreamed in amniotic fluid beneath the membrane. Her arms were folded protectively across her breasts, and her hands were folded lightly into fists under her chin. Her hair had been gathered into a thick, coiled snake on the top of her head, and covered in some kind of web.
"The whole family's here," Prescott murmured at my shoulder. "Husband and wife, and all 61 children. Most have only one or two clones, but Bancroft and his wife run to 6 each. Impressive, huh?"
"Yeah." Despite myself, I had to put out a hand and touch the membrane above Miriam Bancroft's face. It was warm and gave slightly under my hand. There was raised scarring around the entry points of the nutrient feeds and waste pipes, and in tiny pimples where needles had been pushed through to extract tissue samples or provide IV additives. The membrane would give in to such penetrations and heal afterwards. I turned away from the dreaming woman and faced Nyman.
This is all very nice, but presumably you don't shell one of these whenever Bancroft comes in here for transit. You must have tanks as well.
This way.
Nyman gestured us to follow him, and went to the back of the chamber, where another pressure door was set into the wall. The lowest sack swayed eerily in the wake of our passage, and I had to duck to avoid brushing against one. Nyman's fingers played a brief tarantella over the keypad of the pressure door, and we went through into a long, low room, whose clinical illumination was almost blinding after the womb light of the main vault. A row of 8 metallic cylinders, not unlike the one I'd woken up in yesterday, were ranked along one wall. But where my birthing tube had been unpainted and scarred with a million tiny defacements of frequent use, these units carried a thick gloss of cream paint with yellow trim around the transparent observation plate and the various functional protrusions.
"Full life support suspension chambers," Nyman said. "Essentially the same environment as the pods. This is where all the resleeving is done. We bring fresh clones through, still in the pod, and load them here. The tank nutrients have an enzyme to break down the pod wall, so the transition is completely trauma-free. Any clinical work is carried out by staff working in synthetic sleeves, to avoid any risk of contamination."
I caught the exasperated rolling of Almau Prescott's eyes on the periphery of my vision, and a grin twitched at the corner of my mouth.
"Who has access to this chamber?" "Myself, authorized staff under a day code, and the owners, of course."
I wandered down the line of cylinders, bending to examine the data displays at the foot of each one. There was a Miriam clone in the 6th, and 2 Naomis at 7 and 8.
"You've got the daughter on ice twice?" "Yes."
Nyman looked puzzled, and then slightly superior. This was his chance to get back the initiative he'd lost on the fractal patterning.
"Have you not been informed of her current condition?"
"Yeah, she's in psychosurgery," I growled. "That doesn't explain why there's 2 of her here."
"Well..."
Nyman darted a glance back at Prescott, as if to say that the divulging of further information involved some legal dimension. The lawyer cleared her throat.
"Psychosec has instructions from Mr. Bancroft to always hold a spare clone of himself and his immediate family ready for decanting. While Ms. Bancroft is committed to the Vancouver psychiatric stack, both sleeves are stored here."
"The Bancrofts like to alternate their sleeves," Nyman said knowledgeably. "Many of our clients do. It saves on wear and tear. The human body is capable of quite remarkable regeneration if stored correctly, and of course we offer a complete package of clinical repair for more major damage. Very reasonably priced."
"I'm sure it is." I turned back from the end cylinder and grinned at him. "Still, not much you can do for a vaporized head, is there?" There was a brief silence, during which Prescott looked fixedly at a corner of the ceiling, and Nyman's lips tightened to almost anal proportions.
"I consider that remark in very poor taste," the director said finally. "Do you have any more important questions, Mr. Kovach?"
I paused next to Miriam Bancroft's cylinder and looked into it. Even through the fogging effect of the observation plate and the gel, there was a sensual abundance to the blurred form within.
"Just one question. Who decides when to alternate the sleeves?"
Nyman glanced across at Prescott as if to enlist legal support for his words.
"I am directly authorized by Mr. Bancroft to effect the transfer on every occasion that he is digitized, unless specifically required not to. He made no such request on this occasion."
There was something here, scratching at the envoy antenna. Something somewhere fitted. It was too early to give it concrete form. I looked around the room.
"This place is entry-monitored, right?"
"Naturally."
Nyman's tone was still chilly.
"Was there much activity the day Bancroft went to Osaka?"
"No more than usual. Mr. Kovach, the police have already been through these records. I really don't see what value..."
"Indulge me," I suggested, not looking at him, and the envoy cadences in my voice shut him down like a circuit breaker. 2 hours later, I was staring out of the window of another autocab as it kicked off from the Alcatraz landing key and climbed over the bay.
"Did you find what you were looking for?"
I glanced at Alma Prescott, wondering if she could sense the frustration coming off me. I thought I'd got most of the external giveaways on this sleeve locked down, but I'd heard of lawyers who got empath conditioning to pick up more subliminal clues to their witness's state of mind when on the stand. And here, on Earth, it wouldn't surprise me if Almau Prescott had a full infrared subsonic body and voice scan package racked into her beautiful ebony head. The entry data for the Bancroft Vault, Thursday, 16th of August, was as free of suspicious comings and goings as the Mishima Mall on a Tuesday afternoon. 8 a.m., Bancroft came in with two assistants, stripped off, and climbed into the waiting tank. The assistants left with his clothes. 14 hours later, his alternate clone climbed dripping out of the neighboring tank, collected a towel from another assistant, and went to get a shower. No words exchanged beyond pleasantries. Nothing. I shrugged. I don't know. I don't really know what I'm looking for yet. Prescott yawned.
Total absorb, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I looked at her more closely. You know much about the Corps?
Bit. I did my articles in UN litigation. You pick up the terminology. So what have you absorbed so far?
Only that there's a lot of smoke building up around something the authorities say isn't burning. You ever meet the lieutenant who ran the case?
Kristen Ortega. Of course. I'm not likely to forget her. We were yelling at each other across a desk for the best part of a week.
Impressions?
Of Ortega?
Prescott looked surprised.
Good cop, as far as I know. Got a reputation for being very tough. The Organic Damage Division are the police department's hard men, so earning a reputation like that wouldn't have been easy. She ran the case efficiently enough.
Not for Bancroft's liking. Pause. Prescott looked at me warily.
I said efficiently. I didn't say persistently. Ortega did her job, but...
But she doesn't like maths, right? Another pause.
You have quite an ear for the street, Mr. Kovach.
You pick up the terminology, I said modestly. Do you think Ortega would have kept the case open if Bancroft hadn't been a meth? Prescott thought about it for a while.
It's a common enough prejudice, she said slowly. But I don't get the impression Ortega shut us down because of it. I think she just saw a limited return on her investment. The police department has a promotion system based at least partly on the number of cases solved. No one saw a quick solution to this one, and Mr. Bancroft was alive, so...
Better things to do, huh?
Yes, something like that.
I stared out the window some more. The cab was flitting across the tops of slender, multi-story stacks and the traffic-crammed crevices between. I could feel an old fury building in me that had nothing to do with my current problems. Something that had accrued through the years in the core and the emotional rubble you got used to seeing, like silt on the surface of your soul. Virginia Vidara, Jimmy DeSoto dying in my arms at Inanen, Sarah. A loser's catalog, any way you looked at it. I locked it down. The scar under my eye was itching, and there was the curl of the nicotine craving in my fingertips. I rubbed at the scar, left the cigarettes in my pocket. At some indeterminate point this morning, I determined to quit. A thought struck me at random. Prescott, you chose this sleeve for me, right?
Sorry?
She was scanning through a subretinal projection, and it took her a moment to refocus on me.
What did you say?
The sleeve. You chose it, right? She frowned.
No. As far as I know, that selection was made by Mr. Bancroft. We just provided the shortlist according to specifications.
No, he told me his lawyer had handled it. Definitely.
Oh.
The frown cleared away, and she smiled faintly.
Mr. Bancroft has a great many lawyers. Probably he routed it through another office. Why?
I grunted. Nothing. Whoever owned this body before was a smoker, and I'm not. It's a real pain in the balls. Prescott's smile gained ground.
Are you going to give up?
If I can find the time.
Bancroft's deal is, I crack the case, I can be resleeved, no expense spared, so it doesn't really matter long term. I just hate waking up with a throat full of shit every morning.
Do you think you can?
Give up smoking?
No, crack this case.
I looked at her deadpan. I don't really have any other option, Counselor. Have you read the terms of my employment?
Yes, I drew them up.
Prescott gave me back the deadpan look, but buried beneath it were traces of the discomfort I needed to see to stop me reaching across the cab and smashing her nose bone up into her brain with one stiffened hand. Well, well, I said, and went back to looking out of the window.
And my fist up your wife's cunt with you watching, you fucking meth motherfucker, you can't...
I slipped off the headset and blinked. The text had carried some crude but effective virtual graphics and a subsonic that made my head buzz. Across the desk, Prescott looked at me with knowing sympathy. Is it all like this? I asked.
Well, it gets less coherent.
She gestured at the holograph display floating above the desktop, where representations of the files I was accessing tumbled in cool shades of blue and green.
This is what we call the R&R stack. Rapid and rambling. Actually, these guys are mostly too far gone to be any real threat, but it's not nice, knowing they're out there.
Ortega bring any of them in?
It's not her department. The Transmission Felony Division catches a few every now and then, when we squawk loudly enough about it. But dissemination technology being the way it is, it's like trying to throw a net over smoke. And even when you do catch them, the worst they'll get is a few months in storage. It's a waste of time. We mostly just sit on this stuff until Bancroft says we can delete it.
And nothing new in the last 6 months?
Prescott shrugged.
The religious lunatics, maybe. Some increased traffic from the Catholics on Resolution 653. Mr. Bancroft has an undeclared influence in the UN court, which is more or less common knowledge. Oh, and some Martian archaeological sect has been screaming about that song spire he keeps in his hall. Apparently last month was the anniversary of their founder's martyrdom by leaky pressure suit, but none of these people have the wherewithal to crack the perimeter defenses at Suntouch House.
I tilted my chair back and stared up at the ceiling. A flight of gray birds angled overhead in a southward-pointing chevron. Their voices were faintly audible, honking to each other. Prescott's office was environment formatted, all six internal surfaces projecting virtual images. Currently, her gray metal desk was incongruously positioned halfway down a sloping meadow on which the sun was beginning to decline, complete with a small herd of cattle in the distance and occasional birdsong. The image resolution was some of the best I'd seen.
Prescott, what can you tell me about Lila Bagan?
The silence that ensued pulled my eyes back down to ground level. Almau Prescott was staring off into a corner of the field.
I suppose Kristen Ortega gave you that name, she said slowly.
Yeah, I sat up. She said it would give me some insight into Bancroft. In fact, she told me to run it by you to see if you rattled. Prescott swiveled to face me.
I don't see how this can have any bearing on the case at hand.
Try me.
Very well.
There was a snap in her voice as she said it, and a defiant look on her face.
Lila Bagan was a prostitute. Maybe still is. 50 years ago, Bancroft was one of her clients. Through a number of indiscretions, this became known to Miriam Bancroft. The two women met at some function down in San Diego, apparently agreed to go to the bathroom together, and Miriam Bancroft beat the shit out of Lila Bagan.
I studied Prescott's face across the table, puzzled. And that's it?
No, that's not it, Kovach, she said tiredly. Bagan was 6 months pregnant at the time. She lost the child as a result of the beating. You physically can't fit a spinal stack into a fetus, so that made it real death. Potential 3 to 5 decade sentence.
Was it Bancroft's baby? Prescott shrugged.
Debatable. Bagan refused to let them do a gene match on the fetus. Said it was irrelevant who the father was. She probably figured the uncertainty was more valuable from a press point of view than a definite no.
Or she was too distraught?
Come on, Kovac.
Prescott jerked a hand irritably at me.
This is an Oakland whore we're talking about.
Did Miriam Bancroft go into storage?
No, and that's where Ortega gets to stick her knife in. Bancroft bought off everybody. The witnesses, the press, even Began took a payoff in the end, settled out of court. Enough to get her a Lloyd's cloning policy and take her out of the game. Last I heard, she was wearing out her second sleeve somewhere down in Brazil. But this is half a century ago, Kovac.
Were you around?
No.
Prescott leaned across the desk.
And neither was Kristen Ortega, which makes it kind of sickening to hear her whining on about it. Oh, I had an earful of it, too, when they pulled out of the investigation last month. She never even met Began.
I think it might be a matter of principle, I said gently. Is Bancroft still going to prostitutes on a regular basis?
That is none of my concern.
I stuck my finger through the holographic display and watched the colored files distort around the intrusion. You might have to make it your concern, Counselor. Sexual jealousy is a pretty sturdy motive for murder, after all.
May I remind you that Miriam Bancroft tested negative on a polygraph when asked that question?
Prescott said sharply. I'm not talking about Mrs. Bancroft. I stopped playing with the display and stared across the desk at the lawyer before me. I'm talking about the other million available orifices out there, and the even larger number of partners or blood relatives who might not relish seeing some meth fucking them. That's going to have to include some experts on covert penetration, no pun intended, and maybe the odd psychopath or two. In short, someone capable of getting into Bancroft's house and torching him. Off in the distance, one of the cows lowed mournfully. What about it, Prescott? I waved my hand through the holograph. Anything in here that begins, for what you did to my girl, daughter, sister, mother, delete as applicable? I didn't need her to answer me. I could see it in her face. With the sun painting slanting stripes across the desk, and birdsong in the trees across the meadow, Almal Prescott bent to the database keyboard and called up a new purple oblong of holographic light on the display. I watched as it bloomed and opened like some cubist rendition of an orchid. Behind me, another cow voiced its resigned disgruntlement. I slipped the headset back on. Chapter 8. The town was called Ember. I found it on the map about 200 kilometers north of Bay City on the coast road. There was an asymmetrical yellow symbol in the sea next to it.
Free trade enforcer,
Prescott said, peering over my shoulder.
Aircraft carrier. It was the last really big warship anyone ever built. Some idiot ran it aground way back at the start of the colony years, and the town grew up around the site to cater to the tourists.
Tourists? She looked at me.
It's a big ship.
I rented an ancient ground car from a seedy-looking dealership 2 blocks down from Prescott's office and drove north over the rust-colored suspension bridge. I needed time to think. The coastal highway was poorly maintained, but almost deserted, so I stuck to the yellow line in the center of the road and barreled along at a steady 150. The radio yielded a medley of stations whose cultural assumptions were largely above my head. But I finally found a neo-Maoist propaganda DJ, memory-wired into some dissemination satellite that nobody had ever bothered to decommission. The mix of high political sentiment and saccharine karaoke numbers was irresistible. The smell of the passing sea blew in through the open window, and the road unwound ahead of me, and for a while I forgot about the Corps and In-N-In and everything that had happened since. By the time I hit the long curve down into Ember, the sun was going down behind the canted angles of the Free Trade Enforcer's launch deck, and the last of its rays were leaving almost imperceptible pink stains on the surf on either side of the wreck shadow. Prescott was right. It was a big ship. I slowed my speed in deference to the rise of buildings around me, wondering idly how anyone could have been stupid enough to steer a vessel that large so close to shore. Maybe Bancroft knew. He'd probably been around then. Ember's main street ran along the seafront, the entire length of the town, and was separated from the beach by a line of majestic palm trees and a neo-Victorian railing in wrought iron. There were holographic casters fixed to the trunks of the palms, all projecting the same image of a woman's face wreathed with the words Slipside and Cana Salamau in the Rio Total Body Theater. Small knots of people were out, rubbernecking at the images. I rolled the ground car along the street in low gear, scanning the facades, and finally found what I was looking for about two-thirds of the way along the front. I coasted past and parked the car quietly about 50 meters up, sat still for a few minutes to see if anything happened, and then, when it didn't, I got out of the car and walked back along the street. Elliot's Data Linkage Brokerage was a narrow facade sandwiched between an industrial chemicals outlet and a vacant lot where gulls screeched and fought over scraps among the shells of discarded hardware. The door of Elliot's was propped open with a defunct flat-screen monitor and led directly into the operations room. I stepped inside and cast a glance up and down. There were four consoles set in back-to-back pairs, harbored behind a long, molded plastic reception counter. Beyond them, doors led to a glass-walled office. A far wall held a bank of seven monitors, with incomprehensible lines of data scrolling down. A ragged gap in the line of screens marked the previous position of the doorstop. There were scars in the paintwork behind where the brackets had resisted extraction. The screen next to the gap had rolling flickers, as if whatever had killed the first one was contagious.
"Help you?"
A thin-faced man of indeterminate age poked his head around the corner of one of the sloping banks of console equipment. There was an unlit cigarette in his mouth and a trailing thread of cable jacked into an interface behind his right ear. His skin was unhealthily pale.
"Yeah, I'm looking for Victor Elliot."
"Out front."
He gestured back the way I had come.
"See the old guy on the rail, watching the wreck? That's him."
I looked out into the evening beyond the door and picked out the solitary figure at the rail.
"He owns this place, right?"
"Yeah, for his sins."
The data rat cracked a grin and gestured around.
"Not much call for him to be in the office, business the way it is."
I thanked him and went back out onto the street. The light was starting to fade now, and Ancana Salamau's holographic face was gaining a new dominance in the gathering gloom. Crossing beneath one of the banners, I came up next to the man on the rail and leaned my own arms on the black iron. He looked around as I joined him and gave me a nod of acknowledgement, then went back to staring at the horizon, as if he was looking for a crack in the weld between sea and sky.
"That's a pretty grim piece of parking," I said, gesturing out at the wreck.
It earned me a speculative look before he answered me.
"They say it was terrorists."
His voice was empty, disinterested, as if he'd once put too much effort into using it and something had broken.
"Or sonar failure in a storm. Maybe both."
"Maybe they did it for the insurance," I said.
Elliot looked at me again, more sharply.
"You're not from here?"
he asked, a fraction more interest edging his tone this time.
"No, passing through."
"From Rio?"
He gestured up at Ancana Salamau as he said it.
"You an artist?"
"No."
"Oh."
He seemed to consider this for a moment. It was as if conversation was a skill he'd forgotten.
"You move like an artist."
"Near miss. It's military neurochem."
He got it then, but the shock didn't seem to go beyond a brief flicker in his eyes. He looked me up and down slowly, then turned back to the sea.
"You come looking for me? You from Bancroft?"
"You might say that."
He moistened his lips.
"Come to kill me?"
I took the hard copy out of my pocket and handed it across to him.
"Come to ask you some questions. Did you transmit this?"
He read it, lips moving wordlessly. Inside my head, I could hear the words he was tasting again.
"For taking my daughter from me. We'll burn the flesh from your head. We'll never know the hour or the day. Nowhere safe in this life."
It wasn't highly original, but it was heartfelt and articulate in a way that was more worrying than any of the vitriol Prescott had shown me on the Rabbit and Rambling Stack. It also specified exactly the death Bancroft had suffered. The particle blaster would have charred the outside of Bancroft's skull to a crisp before exploding the superheated contents across the room.
"Yes, that's mine,"
Elliot said quietly. "You're aware that someone assassinated Lorenz Bancroft last month." He handed me back the paper.
"That so? The way I heard it, the bastard torched his own head off."
"Well, that's a possibility," I conceded, screwing up the paper and tossing it into a refuse-filled trash bin below us on the beach. "But it's not one I'm being paid to take seriously. Unfortunately for you, the cause of death comes uncomfortably close to your prose style there."
"I didn't do it,"
Elliot said flatly. "I figured you'd say that. I might even believe you, except that whoever did kill Bancroft got through some very heavy-duty security systems, and you used to be a sergeant in the Tactical Marines. Now, I knew some tacks back on Harlan's world, and a few of them were wired for covert wet work." Elliot looked at me curiously.
"You a grasshopper?"
"A what?"
"Grasshopper. Off-worlder."
"Yeah." If Elliot had ever been afraid of me, it was wearing off fast. I considered playing the envoy card, but it didn't seem worth it. The man was still talking.
"Bancroft don't need to bring in muscle from off-world. What's your angle on this?"
"Private contractor," I said. "Find the killer." Elliot snorted.
"And you thought it was me?"
I hadn't thought that, but I let it go, because the misconception was giving him a feeling of superiority that kept the conversation rolling. Something approaching a spark appeared in his eyes.
"You think I could have got into Bancroft's house? I know I couldn't, because I ran the specs. If there was any way in, I would have taken it a year ago, because you would have found little pieces of him scattered on the lawn."
"Because of your daughter?"
"Yes, because of my daughter."
The anger was fueling his animation.
"My daughter and all the others like her. She was only a kid."
He broke off and stared out to sea again. After a moment, he gestured at the Free Trade Enforcer, where I could now see small lights glimmering around what must be a stage set up on the sloping launch deck.
"That was what she wanted. All she wanted. Total body theater. Be like Ancona Salomeo and Rion Lee. She went to Bay City because she heard there was a connection there. Someone who could..."
He jarred to a halt and looked at me. The data rat had called him old, and now for the first time I saw why. In spite of his solid sergeant's bulk and barely swelling waistline, the face was old, carved in the harsh lines of long-term pain. He was on the edge of tears.
"She could have made it, too. She was beautiful."
He was fumbling for something in his pocket. I produced my cigarettes and offered him one. He took it automatically, lit it from the proffered ignition patch on the pack, but went on fumbling in his pockets until he dug out a small Coda crystal. I really didn't want to see this, but he activated it before I could say anything, and a tiny cubed image sprang up in the air between us. He was right. Elizabeth Elliot was a beautiful girl, blonde and athletic, and only a few years younger than Miriam Bancroft. Whether she had the driving determination and horse-like stamina that you needed in total-body theater, the picture didn't show, but she probably could have given it a shot. The hollow shot showed her sandwiched between Elliot and another woman, who was an almost perfect older edition of Elizabeth. The three of them had been taken in bright sunlight, somewhere with grass, and the picture was marred by a bar of shadow falling from a tree beyond the cast of the recorder across the older woman's face. She was frowning as if she had noticed the flaw in the composition, but it was a small frown, a fractional chiseling of lines between her brows. A palpable shimmer of happiness overwhelmed the detail.
"Gone,"
Elliot said, as if he had guessed who my attention was focused on.
"4 years ago. You know what dipping is?"
I shook my head. "Local color," Virginia Fedora said in my ear. "Soak it up." Elliot looked up. For a moment, I thought, at the hollow of Ancona Salamau. But then I saw that his head was tilted at the sky beyond.
"Up there," he said,
and jarred to a halt the way he had when he mentioned his daughter's youth. I waited.
"Up there, you got the commsats, raining data. You can see it on some virtual maps. It looks like someone's knitting the world a scarf."
He looked down at me again, eyes shiny.
"Irene said that. Knitting the world a scarf. Some of that scarf is people. Digitized rich folks on their way between bodies. Skeins of memory and feeling and thought, packaged up by numbers."
Now I thought I knew what was coming, but I kept quiet.
"If you're good, like she was, and you've got the equipment, you can sample those signals. They call them mind bites. Moments in the head of a fashion house princess, the ideas of a particle theorist, memories from a king's childhood. There's a market for this stuff. Oh, the society magazines run edited skull walks of these sorts of people, but it's all authorized, sanitized, cut for public consumption. No unguarded moments, nothing that could embarrass anybody or damage popularity. Just great big plastic smiles on everything. That ain't what people really want."
I had my doubts about that. The Skullwalk magazines were big on Harlan's world as well, and the only time the consumers protested was when one of the notables they portrayed was caught in some moment of human weakness. Infidelity and abusive language were usually the biggest generators of public outcry. It made sense. Anyone pitiful enough to want to spend so much time outside their own head wasn't going to want to see the same basic human realities reflected in the gilded skulls of those they admired.
"With mind bites, you get everything,"
Elliot said with a peculiar enthusiasm I suspected was a graft from his wife's opinions.
"The doubt, the mock, the humanity, people will pay a fortune for it."
"But it's illegal?" Elliot gestured back at the shop front that bore his name.
"The data market was down. Too many brokers. Saturated. We had a clone and re-sleeving policy to pay on both of us, plus Elizabeth. My TAC pension wasn't going to be enough. What could we do?"
"How long did she get?" I asked him softly. Elliot stared out to sea.
30 years.
After a while, stare still fixed on the horizon, he said,
"I was okay for 6 months. Then I turn on the screen and see some corporate negotiator wearing Irene's body."
He half turned toward me and coughed out something that might have been a laugh.
"Corporation bought it direct from the Bay City storage facility. Paid 5 times what I could have afforded. They say the bitch only wears it alternate months."
"Elizabeth know that?" He nodded once, like an axe coming down.
"She got it out of me one night. I was jack-happy. Been cruising the stacks all day looking for business. No handle on where I was or what was going on. You want to know what she said?"
"No," I muttered. He didn't hear me. His knuckles had whitened on the iron railing.
"She said, 'Don't worry, Daddy. When I'm rich, we'll buy Mummy back.'"
This was getting out of hand. "Look, Elliot, I'm sorry about your daughter, but from what I hear, she wasn't working the kind of places Bancroft goes. Jerry's bio cabins isn't exactly the houses, is it?" The ex-tech spun on me without warning, and there was blind murder in his eyes and his crooked hands. I couldn't blame him. All he could see in front of him was Bancroft's man. "But you can't jump an envoy. The conditioning won't let it happen." I saw the attack coming almost before he knew he was going to do it himself. And I had the neurocam of my borrowed sleeve online fragments of a second later. He hit low, driving under the guard he thought I'd put up, looking for the body blows that would break my ribs. The guard wasn't there, and neither was I. Instead, I stepped inside the hooks of his punches, took him off balance with my weight,
and tangled one leg amidst his. He stumbled back against the railing, and I drove a cruel elbow uppercut into his solar plexus. His face went gray with a shock. Leaning over, I pinned him to the rail and jammed the fork of my thumb and fingers into his throat.
"That's enough!"
I snapped, a little unsteadily. The sleeve's Neurochem wiring was a rougher piece of work than the core systems I'd used in the past. In an overdrive, the overwhelming impression was of being slung around in a subcutaneous bag of chicken wire. I looked down at Elliot. His eyes were a handbreadth from mine, and despite the grip I had on his throat, they were still burning with rage. Breath whistled in his teeth as he clawed after the strength to break my grip and damage me. I yanked him off the rail and propped him away from me with a cautionary arm. "Listen, I'm passing no judgments here. I just want to know. What makes you think she has any connection to Bancroft?"
"Because she told me, motherfucker."
The sentence hissed out of him.
"She told me what he'd done."
"And what was that?" He blinked rapidly, the undischarged rage condensing into tears.
"Dirty things," he said. "She said he needed them. Badly enough to come back. Badly enough to pay."
"Meal ticket. Don't worry, Daddy. When I'm rich, we'll buy Mummy back. Easy enough mistake to make when you're young. But nothing comes that easy." "You think that's why she died?" He turned his head and looked at me as if I was a particularly poisonous species of spider on his kitchen floor.
"She didn't die, mister. Someone killed her. Someone took a razor and cut her up."
"Trial transcript says it was a client, not Bancroft."
"How would they know?"
he said dully.
"They name a body. Who knows who's inside it? Who's paying for it all?"
"They find him yet?"
"Bio-cabin whore's killer? What do you think? It ain't exactly like she worked for the houses, right?"
"That's not what I meant, Elliot. You say she turned Bancroft in Jerry's, I'll believe you. But you've got to admit it doesn't sound like Bancroft's style." "I've met the man. And slumming?" I shook my head. "He doesn't read that way to me." Elliot turned away.
"Flesh," he said. "What are you going to read in a meth's flesh?"
It was nearly full dark. Out across the water on the sloping deck of the warship, the performance had started. We both stared at the lights for a while, heard the bright snatches of music, like transmissions from a world that we were forever locked out of. "Elizabeth's still on stack," I said quietly.
"Yeah, so what? Resleeving policy lapsed 4 years ago, when we sank all the money we had into some lawyer said he could crack Irene's case."
He gestured back at the dimly lit frontage of his offices.
"I look like the kind of guy's gonna come into some money real soon?"
There was nothing to say after that. I left him watching the lights and walked back to the car. He was still there when I drove back past him on the way out of the little town. He didn't look around. Part 2. Reaction. Intrusion Conflict. Chapter 9. I called Prescott from the car. Her face looked mildly irritated as it scribbled into focus on the dusty little screen set into the dashboard.
"Kovac, did you find what you were looking for?"
"Still don't really know what I'm looking for," I said cheerfully. "You think Bancroft ever does the bio-cabins?" She pulled a face.
"Oh, please."
"All right, here's another one. Did Lila Began ever work bio-cabin joints?"
"I really have no idea, Kovac."
"Well, look it up then. I'll hold." My voice came out stony. Prescott's well-bred distaste wasn't sitting too well beside Victor Elliot's anguish for his daughter. I drummed my fingers on the wheel while the lawyer went off screen, and found myself muttering a Millsport fisherman's rap to the rhythm. Outside, the coast slid by in the night, but the scents and sounds of the sea were suddenly all wrong, too muted, not a trace of bellyweed on the wind.
"Here we are."
Prescott settled herself back within range of the phone scanner. looking slightly uncomfortable.
Bagan's Oakland records show 2 stints in bio cabins before she got tenure in one of the San Diego houses. She must have had an entree, unless it was a talent scout who spotted her out.
Bancroft would have been quite an entree to anywhere. I resisted the temptation to say it. You got an image there?
Of Bagan?
Prescott shrugged.
Only in 2D. You want me to send it?
Please. The ancient car phone fizzled a bit as it adjusted to the change of incoming signal, and then Lila Bagan's features emerged from the static. I leaned closer, scanning them for the truth. It took a moment or two to find, but it was there. Right. Now can you get me the address of that place Elizabeth Elliot worked? Jerry's closed quarters? It's on a street called Mariposa.
Mariposa and San Bruno.
Prescott's disembodied voice came back from behind Lila Bagan's full-service pout.
Jesus, it's right under the old expressway. That's got to be a safety violation.
Can you send me a map, route marked through from the bridge?
You're going there? Tonight?
Prescott, these places don't do a lot of business during the day, I said patiently. Of course I'm going there tonight. There was a slight hesitation on the other end of the line.
It's not a recommended area, Kovach. You need to be careful.
This time I couldn't be bothered to stifle the snort of amusement. It was like listening to someone tell a surgeon to be careful and not get his hands bloody. She must have heard me.
I'm sending the map, she said stiffly.
Lila Bagan's face blinked out, and a tracery of grid-patterned streets inked themselves into the place she'd been. I didn't need her anymore. Her hair had been iridescent crimson, her throat choked with a steel collar, and her eyes made up with startle lines. But it was the lines of the face below it all that stayed with me. The same lines faintly emergent in Victor Elliot's coda crystal of his daughter. The understated but undeniable similarity. Miriam Bancroft. There was rain in the air when I got back to the city. A fine drizzle sifting down from the darkened sky. Parked across the street from Jerry's, I watched the blinking neon club sign through the streaks and beads of water in the windshield of the ground car. Somewhere in the gloom below the concrete bones of the expressway, a hollow of a woman danced in a cocktail glass. But there was a fault in the caster, and the image kept fizzling out. I'd been worried about the ground car drawing attention, but it seemed that I'd come to the right part of town with it. Most of the vehicles around Jerry's were flightless. The only exceptions to the rule were the autocabs that occasionally spiraled down to disgorge or collect passengers, and then sprang back up into the aerial traffic flow with inhuman accuracy and speed. With their arrays of red, blue, and white navigation lights, they seemed like jeweled visitors from another world, barely touching the cracked and litter-strewn paving while their charges alighted or climbed aboard. I watched for an hour. The club did brisk business. Varied clientele, but mostly male. They were checked at the door by a security robot that resembled nothing so much as a concertinaed octopus strung from the lintel of the main entrance. Some had to divest themselves of concealed items, presumably weapons, and one or two were turned away. There were no protests. You can't argue with a robot. Outside, people parked, climbed in and out of cars, and did deals with merchandise too small to make out at this distance. Once, 2 men started a knife fight in the shadows between 2 of the expressway support pillars, but it didn't come to much. One combatant limped off, clutching a slashed arm, and the other returned to the club's interior as if he'd done no more than go out to relieve himself. I climbed out of the car, made sure it was alarmed, and wandered across the street. A couple of the dealers were seated cross-legged on the hood of a car, shielded from the rain by a static repulsion unit set up between their feet, and they glanced up as I approached.
"Sell you a disc, man? Hot spinners out of Ulaanbaatar, house quality."
I gave them one smooth sweep, shook my head unhurriedly.
"Stiff?"
Another shake. I reached the robot, paused as its multiple arms snaked down to frisk me, then tried to walk over the threshold as the cheap synth voice said, "Clear." One of the arms prodded me gently back at chest height.
"Do you want cabins or bar?"
I hesitated, pretending to weigh it up. "What's the deal in the bar?"
"Ho, ho, ho!"
Someone had programmed a laugh into the robot. It sounded like a fat man drowning in syrup. It cut off abruptly.
"The bar is look, but don't touch. No money down, no hands on. House rule. That applies to other customers, too."
"Cabins," I said, anxious to get away from the mechanical barker's software. The street dealers on the car had been positively warm by comparison.
"Down the stairs to the left. Take a towel from the pile."
I went down the short metal-railed flight and turned left along a corridor lit from the ceiling by rotating red lights like the ones in the auto cabs outside. Incessant junk rhythm music thrashed the air as if this was the ventricle of some massive heart on tetrameth. As promised, there was a pile of fresh white towels and an alcove, and beyond it the doors to the cabins. I walked past the first four, two of which were occupied, and stepped into the fifth. The floor was satin-sheened padding, about 2 meters by 3. If it was stained, it didn't show, because the only illumination came from a single rotating cherry, like the ones in the corridor. The air was warm and stale. Under the sweeping shadows cast by the light, a battered-looking credit console stood in one corner. Stock painted matte black. Red LED digital display at the top. There was a slot for cards and cash. No pad for DNA credit. The far wall was frosted glass.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.